Welcome to the Faster Podcast by Flow Cycling, the podcast where we talk about anything and everything that makes you faster on your bike. This is Season 1, Episode 11, and today we have Max Jones, an owner of Elevate Sports Performance and Chiropractic in Las Vegas, joining us on the show. Max is a movement and biomechanics expert with a diverse background in athletic training. Listen to this episode to learn how movement screening and optimizing your movement patterns can help you become a faster cyclist. Hey, this is Chris with Flow. When we're not producing this podcast, our team at Flow is designing some of the fastest carbon fiber bicycle wheels in the world. As a thank you for being a listener of our podcast, Faster by Flow, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase of wheels at flowcycling.com. Head over to our website and pick up a set of wheels to make you faster at your next race or ride. Simply use coupon code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, in all uppercase letters when checking out to get 20% off your order. Thanks again for listening to Faster. We hope you enjoy the show. All right, so Mr. Max Jones, thank you for coming on the show today. How you doing?
Doing great, Chris. Thanks.
Great. How is Las Vegas treating you?
It's starting to heat up now. So now the infamous desert heat is starting to creep in and spring's over. So we're trying to basically like do as many outside things after 10 a.m. you can. And then you know how it is. It's over. So
yeah. I tell you what, man, I lived there for 11 years and I never got used to the heat. So now that I'm in San Diego, I do not miss that part of Las Vegas, but I do miss some of the rides and the trails that are endless in that area. So, I was thinking before the show, we met at a triathlon. I think it was actually your first triathlon you ever did, Rage in Las Vegas.
That's is that correct. Right? That yeah. is correct.
And I remember you ran D1 in college, and then you also grew up spearfishing in Florida. So you were a good swimmer, a great runner, and like most of us, the bike was a bit of a mystery. I think you had flat pedals for that race, and you still did extremely well. But you have come a super long way. You're frequently on the podium at races now, and you're definitely one of the guys to watch out for, when you're racing. So, that's cool just to see how you've made your way up in the sport. So we've had several guests on the show now. We've had some physical therapists, we've had some sports scientists and some strength and conditioning guys, and all of them have brought up the importance of movement quality and the range of motion that athletes have. So it's definitely something that people are talking about, and we wanted to have you on the show today because you're an expert in that space. And instead of us just saying, hey, you know, you have to move well and you have to have a good range of motion, we wanted to discuss the finer points of this topic. So your background is very extensive. You're one of the owners of Elevate. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Yes. So you're one of the owners of Elevate Sports Performance and Chiropractic in Las Vegas. You have an undergrad in human performance, a master's in kinesiology with a focus on biomechanics. And on top of that, you have a really big background in strength and conditioning, including functional strength. You've got tons of experience with movement and capacity screens, including the FMS, SFMA. And now you've even developed some of your own testing screens for athletes that take both performance and injury prevention into account. So when we talked on the phone a few weeks ago about this podcast, you said for lay people, I think the best way to describe what you are is a movement and biomechanics expert who is a really high level strength coach. Is that a fair assessment of who you are?
Yeah, I would just say I'm a strength coach with a movement inclination. You know, I don't think anyone's an expert in anything. I think that's for other people to call you, not yourself.
It comes. Well, across, I'm calling right? you an expert. So basically, you're just a big movement and strength nerd.
That's probably appropriate.
All right, cool, awesome. All right, man, let's get into some of the questions and let's just start to talk about movement and capacity screening. So let's start with, what is a movement screen?
Right. So basically, a movement screen is essentially a list or a series of movements that you can do to screen out the potentiality of things going from an injury prevention standpoint, not the best way. Obviously, if I, find in a movement screen, someone has some dysfunctional patterns, that's a word we use as functional, or you're dysfunctional. It does not necessarily mean you're going to get injured tomorrow next time you get on a bike or you go for a run or things like that. It just lets you know that you have a prevalence to have in that area. So a screen is only as good as the screen. That's what it is. It's not a prediction chart. It's not a causality thing or any of those sort of things. So movement screens are essentially just to let you know it's not optimal. And there are some things that obviously help you bias to what you're going to do next. And screens are nice because they're quick, they're effective. It creates a bridge of communication, if you will, between a client or an athlete and the coach. So there's not a, there isn't just some ambiguity where a coach says, well, you squat funny. You know, and then you basically just walk around with that kind of mentality going, thinking about movement. And then, you know, with a screen, you can actually, there's metrics for moving well, and then there's metrics for moving not well. And I can show you, and that creates a great kind of communication bridge. So, you know, we talk about buy-in a lot in the endurance world. You talk about buy-in in the strength conditioning world of creating buy-in between your client, and screens do a really good job of that. So.
Very cool. Okay, so now I've done a bit of this in the past. I've actually read Gray Cook's book, the big 460-page version of his movement screens. But there really are, from what I can understand, there's two popular movement screens. There's the FMS, and then which is the functional movement screen, and then the SFMA, which is the selected functional movement assessment. What are each of those, and how do they compare and contrast with each other?
Right. So Cook, or Gray Cook, the whole FMS, the functional movement system kind of umbrella, created a movement screen. That's the one you're familiar with. The FMS is essentially a movement screen to essentially use as an intake for athletes or clients or our general population. So if you kind of want to draw a big line in the sand, metaphorically, you use the FMS kind of as your intake to get people moving from a fitness standpoint or training or whatnot. The second an athlete presents with pain, the SFMA, the selected functional movement assessment, is something that you could essentially use to sift out why that person's having pain and then identify the dysfunction to that pain. So something that where the movement industry and the fitness and healthcare industry is starting to get much better at is starting to identify, well, if your knee hurts, we're not going to just treat the knee. We're going to look at the hip. We're going to look at the ankle. So what it means is it looks at things from a systemic point of view versus a kind of a isolated point of view. And the SFMA basically helps you do that at a higher level and when a person's in pain. Because if you could think about, you know what the FMS entails, like if someone has a bum knee, doing an FMS on them isn't going to tell you anything because they've already going to change their movement patterns, right? So if you're hurt, you're going to limp, right? So you're not going to, it's going to be a not, you know, a true test, if you will.
That okay.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, totally. We actually interviewed.
So hold on, just a sec. So the SFMA though, how does that compare to the FMS?
Right. So basically so if you wanted to know more in-depth information about someone, say they weren't in pain, the SFMA is good because it's a joint by joint approach to looking at certain movement patterns. So like a couple tests on there is like, can you touch your toes? Can you stand on one leg for 10 to 15 seconds? And then basically there's a top tier in the SFMA where it basically is it's its own screen of 10 movements. And then based on what you're not great at, AKA dysfunctional, you break out that pattern into a series of algorithms to break that out. So you guys are engineering nerds.
Yep.
So basically you guys like algorithms and matrices for everything. So if I can, you know, say someone has an issue touching their toes, well, you can assume on the front end that they're going to maybe have an issue in the hip, core stability, ankles, spinal angles, things like that. And you're actually going to have a whole flow chart of assessments to break that out. So you can actually identify why, back to the global screen, why they can't touch their toes. So, and that's really powerful if it's run well.
That's so really cool.
So it's a system, right? And, you know, systems run better than kind of than everything in regards to just, or from shooting from the hip.
Yep.
So
perfect.
And that's kind of what the SMA is used for.
Cool.
So we've worked with a group called Revo PT out of Boulder, Colorado. We interviewed them on the show. So they're physical therapists. You also have, you know, chiropractors. Can you explain the main difference between what you do and what like a PT or a chiropractor would do?
Right. Yeah. So, and, you know, kind of on the front end, like I am a strength conditioning coach. I don't have a doctorate in DPT or a doctor of chiropractic. And I work with a, you know, fantastic chiropractor in our facility.
Right.
So basically what I do is I work in tandem with someone like that. And in theory, the physical therapist or the chiropractor is someone that handles people that are on a pain side of things, right? So basically, right. we use that proverbial, you know, line in the sand as the pain line. So as soon as an athlete or a client crosses that pain line, they are now in what I call the doctor's ballpark. You know, and again, in our scene of things, we use the DPT and Chiro almost synonymously. Yeah. Some people would do a really good job. They would try and make a really big deal to kind of disassociate from the other, you know, profession and whatnot. But at the end of the day, they're looking at movement, they're treating pain, and then they basically hopefully are addressing symptom and dysfunction, getting people moving better. At the top tip of the pyramid of the people who make up these systems and stuff, yeah, they're synonymous. Like, you know, so as you're aware, like those are people that, you know, they help you move better, treat pain, things like that. So I guess the difference between me and those guys, if you're going to do that, is I look at movement from a preventative standpoint, and basically ongoing assessment, things like that. And then when I do, you know, athletes have pain in front of me all the time. And, you know, and then I transition them to a chiro or PT, and then I get them back when they're out of pain. But I think it is again, kind of being a more enlightened strength coach, it helps me in a communication barrier with a DPT or a chiropractor to basically say, hey, I ran a more in-depth movement screen called the SFMA. Here are some of the dysfunctions I found. Back me up and run the system again and see if it came up with the same output, right? So right. If you get the output twice, then you know the doc has got a good, you know, they've got a pretty good chance of nailing the issue and then the best outcome for the patient or client, right?
Very cool.
Perfect.
So what does a general movement screen tell an athlete? Is it telling us that we move, you know, does it highlight our risk for potential injury? Does it just tell us that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe we've learned something incorrectly over the years? What does it tell us?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty global, but basically I'll use something that I'm familiar with. A general movement screen of FMS basically lets you know that in seven different movement patterns, someone moves well, in basically patterns like a squat, single leg stability. Do they have appropriate mobility in the shoulders, the ankles, the hips? And basically it helps you kind of draw a picture that you probably need to, if they don't move well in a certain area, then you can probably bias. I always say I like biasing our training process based on our assessments, to then kind of, that's your insertion point for training. So for example, right. If someone doesn't squat well because they have ankle mobility issues, that's something that people are starting to get familiar with. Then day one, I'm not going to give them a weight and goblet squat them or back squat them or whatever. It's going to allow me to essentially, you know, I might do a heels up goblet squat to allow them to train, but I'm still helping them with their ankle mobility, right? So it allows you to have a good insertion point for your training. So I think I answered that well.
No, yeah.
Yeah. And the one major point is screens. I have to say this right. The movements are... they are related, but they're not dependent on each other, right? So why someone doesn't move well in like a deep squat may not lend themselves to why they don't have issues in rotator stability. There's probably some like indirect correlation. It's indirect at best, yep. But it's not 100%, right?
Okay, that makes sense.
Very cool.
Right. And so is doing a movement screen something that's only for a professional and a trained eye? Or is it something that we can learn on by ourselves? And if that's the case, is it something that you want to do on a regular basis? Mm-hmm. Like how often do you get a movement screen?
Right. Yeah. So you know, we know how adaptations happen in a training side of things. So we know like muscles build and probably, you know, no earlier than 6 to 8 weeks and power gains can happen in that time phase. And, you know, it takes 3 to 6 months to put on actual weight in terms of muscle. Well, and then, but backing that up initially, why do people get stronger? So a lot of people talk about this on the beginning of endurance program or strength program is you're getting neurological adaptations, right?
Right.
So you're basically, your body's getting more efficient at whatever movement. So that's why watts can go up on a bike pretty quickly or somebody gets more efficient at the X activity. So a squat, for example. So bringing it back to the movement screen, you can see neurological change in a movement screen. And that's actually what's super powerful. If someone presents with someone who can't touch their toes. So if there's any listeners out there can't touch their toes and they have a mobility or stability restriction, not letting them do that. Well, if I input the right inputs, right? So we're mm-hmm. talking algorithms again, I can get the output of and them touching their toes within 8 to 10 minutes. That's awesome. If that is the correct fix or the correct input, right?
Right.
So a movement screen, basically it can be done in a frequency that is appropriate for if the interventions were carried out, right?
Okay.
The appropriate interventions. As far as anyone doing it, I think the systems are built well enough that anyone, you can, the rules of what gives you a score, like what is a 3 on the deep squat. So for listeners, the FMS has a score ratio of a 1, 2, and 3. A 3 is an exceptional ninja movement. a 2 is essentially 80% of the bell curve people fall within the 2 range. And then a dysfunctional movement is a 1. So someone presents as a 1, then obviously that was something you would address more time on. And then 2s would be good. And then 3s would be exceptional. You probably don't need to mess with that person and fixing that pattern. They need to train. They don't need to stretch and mobilize. They need to go. Okay. So that, if hopefully that answered it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm guessing that there's somewhat of an analytical eye that needs to be taken into consideration. So, I mean, some people can really observe movement very well. If they're kinesthetically aware, if they're visual type people, they can see that. Mm-hmm. If they're not, then maybe it's best left for somebody who has a trained eye.
Right. Yeah. And okay. Obviously, you know, most of these do have, you know, certifications and people can seek these people out. But the nice empowering thing about it is some of the tests are actually pretty like, can you stand on one leg? Can you do a squat? And they kind of let you know what are metrics that you shouldn't see. So you could, in theory, stand in front of a mirror and do a movement screen of some sort. And you could kind of self-identify, you know, you have certain issues, you know.
Okay. So. Awesome. So with all the screens that you've done and all the people that you've worked with, what are some of the biggest problems you find when doing movement screens?
You want to put a, in terms of the logistics of it or what I see in people?
What you see in people. Not the logistics.
What type issues? What type of athlete? Want to go cyclist?
Let's go cyclist.
Right. So as you know, power is produced through the foot, through the pedal and whatnot. So having a fixed ankle, right, is a good thing. A fixed lever versus a mobile lever in that regard is a good thing, right?
Right.
So, and if I do a movement screen on someone and I'm looking at ankle mobility, a cyclist has become very efficient, and I know we're going to get into that a little later, at being in a fixed ankle position, right? So if you want to transition to a swimmer, they're going to be dragging boat anchors behind them when they're in the water, right? So so obviously, and something that will make more global is because someone doesn't move well on a movement screen does not make them bad at their sport. Sometimes you develop adaptations to be effective at your sport, right? So again, a cyclist has developed certain mobility restrictions in their lumbar and thoracic spine to get them more aerodynamic. They probably have some wrist postures that they are more, you know, like if you took a cyclist and made him a golfer, he might have some wrist issues because their wrist has only been moving a certain way for so long versus another sport. So that basically is the, I would, and so to be cut and dry, talking too philosophical, is I would say hip and ankle probably mobility is probably the most limited things. And then in a cyclist moving in a contralateral or opposing pattern, because, you know, it's not running, it's not crawling, it's not wrestling. It's not a sport that essentially has you move in opposites,
right?
Like in terms of upper and lower body connection or slings, that's what we call it a lot.
Okay.
You'll probably see some goofy stuff if I had a pure cyclist start skipping around. You know, and that's a pretty good way to kind of, if you want to see someone's coordinated, have them go skip and then you can see what you see.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
Pretty cool. So if you look at the athletic population, let's use cyclists again as another example.
Right.
What percentage of cyclists do you think have a limited range of motion?
I would say, if it's an appropriate adaptation, I would say, you know, from an ankle stability, I would say 80-90%. Yeah, I would say it's a large population of cycling. It would just because it's something that is, if they are not doing something actively, you know, intentionally outside of the sport, which, you know, inherently endurance athletes are known to not do things outside of their sport. That is, you know, that is obviously you're going to get efficient at that pattern, which is cycling.
Right.
You know, so that's something that, I would say a vast majority of people, would have limitations there. From a global movement standpoint, you know, if you want to talk about, is that good for performance? Would I loosen up Chris Froome's ankles? going for a week before the Tour de France? Probably not, right?
Yeah.
So because that's where he creates power from. So again, you know, separating efficient patterns from optimal for sport and health, sometimes there is a delineation there.
Okay. And so you've talked about the adaptive portion of a sport specific thing. So let's say, you know, you have a limited range of motion in the ankle because it produces more power. What are some of the life, you know, events that we go through that could cause a limited range of motion, like sitting at a desk or, you know, things like that? Do you have any list of common things that cause a limited range of motion?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, you know, modern society has turned us into just pure automation. So we don't have to obviously burn calories to get calories. So obviously, you know, you and I can all sit on our butts right now and order Postmates and we wouldn't have to move to get any calories right now, which is obviously a cool technological thing, but it's probably not great from a movement or health standpoint. So any you know, obviously any extending sitting posture is going to develop, you know, hip issues. It's called glute amnesia. It's not really a real medical term, but basically your glutes don't extend the hip appropriately as well. Tight ankles, things like that. Obviously internally rotated shoulders, you know, the desk, iPhone, or excuse me, I don't want to sponsor iPhone, but the texting posture, computer posture, things like that. So, I mean, if you sat someone in an airplane chair for 5 hours, flew them across the country and have them get up, you probably would see a big extrapolation of what's wrong with modern society right now of movement issues. So
that's one of the reasons I hate flying.
Yeah, we've made several trips to Taiwan, and every time we get off that plane, we were on a plane last year, and I did like a full stretch workout on the plane, like trying to find corners and places where I could do these weird stretches.
And most people call the flight attendant on you, right?
John's
exactly. But yeah, I get off the plane though, not looking like I was sitting at a desk though. It felt pretty good.
Right.
John is that guy. On the plane. Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing too is to add to that, being seated in a chair, we get a very altered pelvic posture. So if you think of like an elite level sprinter, and then when they walk around on the track, they're walking on their toes. So if you have a part of the body that is very far forward, there's something that's going to have to counteract to move them back, and that typically is in the pelvis. So we call that anterior pelvic tilt. Yep. So a lot of people that are in extended seated postures as well, they don't really sit in an appropriate neutral pelvis spine position. So yoga does a really good job of talking about this. Elite lifters talk about having a good pelvic posture, but something that we see as something that we have to kind of work on a lot with people coming in the door is establishing what neutral pelvis is and helping people, because when they do squats and deadlifts and do all the sexy lifts, they're not feeling their glutes appropriately, or they lack single leg stability. We have to actually establish pelvic posture on their back first before we can move them on to more neurologically demanding things like squats, lunges, you know, stuff that people resonate with, you know.
I started doing this program, you know, recently, or a few years ago now, but they talk a lot about PPT or posterior pelvic tilt. Mm-hmm. And the first time I tried to do that, it was like the biggest, it's very difficult because like you say, most of everything is anterior based. And so that's easy to do, right? Everybody can do that because that's how we, but the concept of even getting, you know, to a PPT state is very difficult. So neutral, it makes a lot of sense. It's difficult to get there.
And anyone seated in a chair can do it. If you just basically sat in a chair, and then if you notice there's a lumbar curvature, or basically like a tunnel, we call it the tunnel.
Yeah.
And you basically, if you just cue someone to say, hey, use your core and crush the tunnel, we can do this in a seated posture on their back, help them establish it in a standing posture before we do a lift. That usually helps clean up a lot of issues. It's almost shocking when people come in and I have them do a glute bridge. So viewers out there, if you lay on your back, pick up your pelvis, and knees bent, your hips are going to rise. A lot of people, you know, report, hey, I feel my quads, my hamstrings are cramping, my calves, my back, everything but their glutes, which the damn name is exercise is named after glutes. So, but if you help people establish a better pelvic posture just by having them use their core to get to neutral, like you're talking about, you usually can change really on the spot where people are feeling, a bridge, for example.
And that,
again, building buy-in, that's something that, you know, is big deal on our side of things.
Very cool.
All right, let's switch gears just a touch. When we talked on the phone, you said that our bodies are always striving to become more efficient. And because many of us, like we're talking about sitting at a desk, because many of us sit at a desk all day, we learn to hunch because hunching is the most efficient position to be in when you're at a desk. So as life goes on, you said that our brains are always updating our internal software to be more efficient. I really like that analogy. So that includes our range of motion mm-hmm. and our movement patterns. Mm-hmm. When it comes to sports, unfortunately, being efficient at sitting at a desk job doesn't really translate well to cycling or running or whatever you're doing. So can you talk a little bit about this brain-body connection and how neglecting our movement causes us to become, you know, for lack of better terms, bad at moving?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the easiest thing is to kind of establish that, you know, we consciously move our muscles, right? But our brain is obviously signaling, like, so if I flex my elbow to, you know, make a bicep muscle and show off my biceps, essentially your brain is communicating that to your body. But there's a ton of subconscious of that happening as well. So I like to say when we're born, our body is born with, you know, the optimal software for moving well. So I have a little 8-month-old girl. She's learning how to move and stand up and going through the throes of every parent that's listening to this knows, like, they, you know, they army crawl, then they bear crawl, then they start getting up, then they figure it out on their own. That's something that doesn't need to be coached. That's a very internally coached system. It's like a auto updating right. system.
Yes.
So, and then basically, obviously, as we get to, you know, 5 or 6 years old, we develop the ability to skip, jump, be athletic, and then do things that are, you know, more athletic, and then we go and, you know, go about life. And then our body is our hardware. So we have our bones, ligaments, and muscles. That's our hardware. So as obviously as you know, like our hardware gets bigger and gets stronger and does actually, you know, what we ask it to do as we get older. But, you know, so again, going back to, we get more efficient at patterns, our brain is always striving for efficiency from the standpoint of calorie preservation, right? So, you know, we are wired to do two major tasks from an evolution standpoint. We're probably, you know, we probably need to store fat or store calories and to live long enough to reproduce. And that's basically like the two major functions of our DNA. And as far as that goes, there's not much in there about like, well, we need to move well. Like, no, that's not in there. That's something that modern society has developed a schema that we need to think about. So kind of bringing it back all in, you know, we get efficient at patterns. We do a lot because that's something we're basically teaching our brain that says, oh, well, you know, if Chris and John are going to be here, we might as well get pretty good at it and conserve right. calories. So that's being seated at the desk. That's, you know, poor postures when walking, having your whole shoulders hunched forward, being on the phone, things like that. So switching gears to being more athletic, or, you know, athleticism just in general, before you even get into sport specific stuff like cycling, running, and swimming, we know that you probably need to be a good mover, or at least have a standard of, you know, moving well to enjoy these sports, right? So most of these people are just amateur, you know, level athletes, and you just need to kind of have a good, you know, I'm a good mover to then proceed to do this activity. And unfortunately, modern society has kind of reversed engineered, and not in a great way, for us to not do that very well. Okay. And I think it affects people in injury or performance and whatnot. So
interesting. Okay. Now, when we started this off, we talked about movement screening, but I've also heard you talk about capacity
right.
test. What is a functional capacity test?
Right. So everyone's probably familiar with like VO2 max tests, and there's FTPs and things like that to measure like physiological.
We just
peaks.
Did one.
Right. Right. Yeah. How'd it go? What are number? What's the numbers? The numbers.
It was hard. John was 49. I was 62. And then I think there's talk of retesting here in the next mm-hmm. few months. So could be some interesting stuff.
Oh, really? Cool. That's news to me.
I know. I just built a blood lactate profile exercise program in Trainer Road. Mm-hmm. I bought a lactate testing kit, so we're going to do that. And I think we're going to have one of the leading experts in lactate profiling on the podcast.
Wow.
I'm trying to convince him right now. But anyway, we're doing a lot of sports science stuff too with this show.
Cool.
So
cool.
Anyway,
love it.
Yeah,
love it.
I'll let you get back.
Yeah. So basically, the movement side of things has developed a capacity test. So one thing that they realized was we have a ton of, you know, the movement systems out there, and FMS just isn't the only one. There's a ton of other ones. they developed a really good idea of, okay, this person moves well, this person has dysfunction, we can address it, yada, yada. How do we actually measure athletic capacity without getting sport specific, right? So if I have a cyclist throw and catch a ball 90 miles an hour, that makes him a good pitcher, has no inclination he's going to be a good cyclist, right? Or things like that. So what they sought out to do was come up with a human athleticism test. So they basically, again, took it back to what we develop as kids. So we learned to, you know, we jump off stuff, we skip, and then we carry things. So, you know, carry things around the house, things like that. So the functional capacity test, or the FCS, it's the fundamental capacity screen. I might've misspoke on the phone with you, Chris.
Okay.
But essentially it's a capacity test that looks at raw power, like how far can you broad jump? So I know, barring that they move well in the FMS with me, I would transition an athlete to doing this capacity test. So I know if you can't jump your body height, so you guys are what, 6 foot, 5'11"?
Yep.
5'11".
So yeah. So, if you can't jump your height, I already know I have a power output issue right there. So that's basically a pass fail for me. You have to be able to jump your height. And basically there's metrics associated with these tests to let us know, again, to bias your training system. So you don't just start someone here. So there's things like a broad jump, a single leg broad jump, funny ones where you got to keep your hands on your hips and then try and broad jump. That always messes people up. And then another one's a carry test, or a farmer's carry. So most people in the gym world would know it as carrying a weight in each hand and going for a walk with it. So I know if an athlete has, the lack of the ability to carry between 50 and 75% of their body weight distributed into both hands, then we have a postural strength issue. So it allows me to then bias my training process. Say for example, so we treat training like buckets, right? So if I have a strength bucket, I have a movement bucket, I have a conditioning bucket, I have a flexibility, I have that's probably good enough. So if I assess someone and get through all this sort of stuff, and I find that, oh, Chris has got a huge broad jump, he's got single leg stability, he can triple jump really well. So I already know off the top of my head, he's able to transfer power well, he has good absolute power, he's symmetrical on his left and right leg, but then he's really crap at his farmer's carry and can't carry 50% of his body weight. Well, then let's fix that bucket first and then address the postural strength thing first. So then it allows me to essentially look at things from that standpoint of, okay, well, we're going to buy, instead of having you do more jump or plyometric based things, you've already shown me that that bucket is full for the requirements of your sport. Let's hang out on this other side and do more carry, slower strength movement based stuff to then fix that bucket. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's kind of like a combine, NFL combine, for your everyday guy to see how he's moving. That's really, really cool.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So you have also developed a bit of your own movement screen yourself for, I think, triathletes, right? Talk a little bit about what you have put together.
Yeah. So, we talked about this on the phone a little bit. I'm not a big fan of talking about sport-specific training, things like that, but we do know that certain movement patterns lend themselves to be effective for being a good ex-athlete. So we know, our facility does work with a lot of golfers and kind of country club Henderson here in Las Vegas. So there's a whole movement system called the Titleist Performance Institute has developed a screen to basically use for golfers specifically. And then what, again, it does is it allows a trainer or a doctor to then do a movement screen for a golfer to then allow them to know, hey, you don't move well in X, Y, and Z. This might mean why you aren't moving well on swinging the golf club. So obviously, again, great bridge of communication, smart business move. There is no movement screens that I know of right now that do this for endurance athletes. So I'm doing this essentially. I've developed a movement system, again, taking the best from everything, not reinventing the wheel, and then did it for triathletes. So again, breaking it out from a sport-specific standpoint, what are the movements that need to be effective in swimming? So obviously you need to have good, you know, good shoulder mobility and external and internal rotation. So your pull phase, obviously we know is internal rotation, lat engagement, all that sort of stuff, and then being able to move through. So I can just tell you, and if you were standing or you were laying down on a bench, if you have inadequate shoulder mobility, we know there's going to be issues in the pool side of things. And that's what your swim coach who, or your master's coach has been telling you, you over rotate, you do this, you do certain movements like that. So then it allows me to look at, all right, can this person not achieve a higher performance because they have a skill-based issue in that sport, or do they have a movement issoe? And then obviously on my side of the fence, I can address a movement issue. So again, you know, looking at thoracic spine rotation, if they don't rotate well in their T-spine, then they're not going to turn well in the water. So they might have breathing issues. They can't bilaterally breathe. They can't perform the requirements of sport. Moving down, and again, I did this for cycling, looking at hip range of motion, ankle range of motion, actually wrist posture. So if you have really crappy wrist posture, hinging your wrist, we know that being on a road bike or a TT position in some states is going to be an issue. And then doing the same thing for running as well. And then looking at what are the important mechanics that need to happen in the hip, the knee, and the ankle, and even in the upper body as well. To essentially, bias that. So again, we want to separate, is this person not good at their sport because they lack the skill? And I know triathlon is a little less about skill movements, but swimming is very technical. So if you lack certain movements, is it because you lack the movement capability because your brain, your body can't do it? Or you just need to do more reps in the pool, right?
Right.
And same regard into cycling and running. So that's kind of what we've done.
Okay. So I want to get into eventually how we can improve movement. But before we do that, I want to talk about the effect that poor movement can have on our performance. So a lot of athletes look at, how can I get faster? How can I get better? And a lot of times we assume that that's an engine problem. But when we've talked in the past, you've told me that a lot of guys who think they have an engine problem really have a chassis problem. So tell me how a limited range of motion or a poor movement pattern can hurt an athlete.
Right. So, I mean, just really simple. We know, and let's use running, for example, we know that speed is developed from stride frequency times stride length, right? That's a very accepted kinesiology-based thing. You can take a longer step or you can have a bigger stride frequency. And Usain Bolt does it the best. That's why he's the fastest, right?
Yes.
So bringing it back to from a performance standpoint, especially for distance people, is if you lack certain hip ranges or ankle ranges, things like that, your brain, I like to say our brain is smarter than we are in regards to it will limit certain ranges of motion that it deems unsafe. So again, bringing it back to, how a toe touch, if you cannot touch your toes, your brain is essentially self-regulating this pattern to not let you do that to keep you safe.
Right.
So when the person says, I can't touch my toes in the morning, but if I sit there and forward fold and that instructor pushes me in half and I grab a weight and I let myself stretch, I'll get there. And I'm like, great. Let's see if it's there tomorrow. And that's all well and good if that's what you need to do. But that being said, if we are lacking a range of motion, use running in the hips, and we're not able to achieve appropriate hip flexion, hip extension, or you're not using the right muscles to achieve hip flexion, hip extension, that's directly going to limit performance because A, you can't reach the range of motion to reach X speed, which gives you the ability to train at the speeds you need to perform well.
Okay.
Or you're just going to get injured before you're going to get to that point, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. All right. So you brought up golf earlier on this show and you said, because golf has a lot more money than triathlon does, maybe not cycling, but golf certainly has a lot of money. They've done a much better job at separating range of motion and movement. Because, these are different things. And so I want you to talk about that. But before you do, I want to bring up another thing that you've said in the past. You have so many good analogies. So let's say that the range of motion that we need is 0 to 60 degrees. And I'm just bringing up random numbers. But if an athlete only has 0 to 45, mm-hmm. their brain, essentially their neurological system, may have forgotten about those extra 15 degrees. So while we may have, once we get the range of motion back, we may have the range of motion mechanically, but you said neurologically, we don't own that range of motion yet because our brain has essentially forgotten about it. So can you talk a little bit about the difference between range of motion and movement, just to help us understand the difference?
Right. Yeah. So when we're talking about range of motion in major joints, there's two major ranges of motion to kind of dictate. There's a passive range of motion. There's an active range of motion. So if I said, you know, go ahead and stand nice and tall and grab that right knee and pull it to your chest, your femur and your hip are going to move in a certain way, and then you're going to get to a certain range of motion. And, you know, let's say you can bring your knee to your chest, say you have really good hip range of motion. So that is the anatomical range, or excuse me, the threshold of what your movement is, right? Okay. So that's your passive range of motion, right? So then if I just say, okay, athlete X, let go of your hands and keep your leg in that same spot, that's going to be your active range of motion. So, right. And then that's when your brain and your muscles, your core and your hips. So again, using that knee to chest example, if someone had to stand as tall as they could and grab that knee, pull it as high as they can, and then have to let go, we're going to see most likely a big difference between what their passive was when they're holding on to it and then their active when they let go.
Okay.
So naturally we can assume that when we're doing athletic movements, that is the active range of motion, right?
Right.
So if you have a giant discrepancy between your passive and your active, and the active is what you can control, then we know that we have a big, you know, we have a big window of opportunity to help you move better. But if that active range of motion is so limited that we can't, you know, do certain movements, or we keep getting hurt, things like that, that allows us to kind of bias our training process there. So I guess to break that out, so that handles range of motion. I guess movement would be global movement, or the synergy or the integration of active ranges of motion in the appropriate way.
Okay.
And that would kind of be the easiest way to get out from that discussion.
So basically, if we don't have the proper range of motion, we can't do the movement, right?
Right.
Okay. So let's I'm going to ask you two separate questions then. So let's pretend or assume that we do not have the proper range of motion. How do you improve an athlete's range of motion?
Right. So we know, so again, we're having like a neurological discussion right now. So how do we essentially how do you take an active range of motion and then get it closer to what your passive looks like, right?
Okay.
So we know that that one of the best signals to the brain, and again, I'm going to use that knee to chest example, is isometric. So isometric is when a muscle doesn't move through its range of motion; it's actually just under contraction in one spot. So we know that the signal, or the volume, I like to say, is loudest when we do isometric. So if I have you, you know, push against the wall as hard as you can, and it's not going to move, well, then your chest and your arms will do a lot of work. So again, talking about improving range of motion, we use isometrics to increase that active range of motion. And the brilliant thing is, because it's neurological, we are not looking at strength or muscular adaptations. We can see this in real time in 5 to 7 minutes. Okay. So period there. It's really hard.
Right.
It's very difficult. So if I, so when I'm talking about hip range of motion, and, you know, and I'll use that knee to chest example, if I have you let that go, I guarantee you're going to not be able to hold it there longer than about 10 to 10 seconds. So it's a very hard contraction. And, you know, when I'm coaching people, I'm yelling, the motivation factor is really high. And you have to basically create a high level of neurological stimulus. So you're having them flex their hands, flexing their core. It's a full body contraction to then achieve more range of motion in one joint. And that's essentially the start of how we start influencing bigger range of motion in whatever area that you deem it's not good in.
Okay, cool.
A lot of yelling and screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gets kind of, I mean, you know, and I'll like, so I work with a high school, local high school team, Coronado High School, and they're a really awesome cross country track program. A lot of them had very limited, hip ranges and ankle ranges, things like that. So basically for the first 3 to 4 weeks, our kind of getting started program was a ton of this end range work, where I'd have them partner up, or, you know, threesomes, foursomes of people, and I'd have them kind of do these hip ranges of motion, and they're screaming at each other. Like, it's like they're honestly going to war at each other. And the idea is, again, it's brilliant, because if you can ramp up these kids' neurological system to get a bigger range of motion, then it's going to transfer right over to them running faster, sprinting or cycling or running, and you can make the parallel wherever you want, because it's usable range of motion versus the passive, not usable overstretching. And I guess to get clear, we don't do a whole lot of static or passive stretching in our facility. We use a ton of active range of motion, isometric and range of motion. So I guess to delineate, we flexibility is our definition. I'm sure there's a lot, is the ability for the tissue to lengthen and extend. Like, that's flexibility for us. Yep. And then a mobility is essentially the in regards to the joint range of motion. So to get super nerdy, you have a certain amount of mechanoreceptors in a joint and muscles, things like that. And those basically are the little signals from the muscles, the brain. So when the brain sends a signal to the hip, you need to pick up your hip. Those are the things that do stuff to make the leg move. You have a much higher concentration of mechanoreceptors in your joints than you do in your muscles. So if you're trying to change movement quickly, it makes sense to do it from a joint range, aka mobility standpoint. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so step one is really getting the range of motion. And then once we have that, how do we then improve our movement patterns?
Right. So if we're discussing range of motion as more of an isolated area, like a hip,
right.
And we're seeing a movement pattern like a squat be limited, well, obviously the integration of that movement, kind of reinstating that movement is the idea. So if someone has a, say for example, someone's knee dives in when they squat or something, they call it valgus. It doesn't look pretty when their knee dives past their midline. It's not good for the knee and it doesn't look good. We would essentially use certain movement patterns after establishing hip range, like looping a band around their knee and forcing them into the dysfunction. So they have to actively teach themselves, okay, I'm doing this more global movement now. I'm not thinking about hip anymore. I'm trying to do this squat the appropriate way. So it's actually pretty fascinating to watch people after you've changed some things, like from a hip or an ankle or big global things, how they'll kind of almost have the headlights eyes of that they'll surprise themselves or when they touch their toes.
Really?
And again, because it's neurological, there might be someone that hasn't touch their toes, use that example for 10 years, and then you give that to them because that was the appropriate input output. That's when you're doing your job right. And that's what's exciting for us. When you can actually create that change, especially in the people that haven't, it's more powerful for people that haven't done something and you give it back to them versus someone who's had it, lost it, and you give it back.
Perfect.
In my opinion.
Nice. Let's say that you get, you gain more of the range of motion in that, in that you've increased that active level that you've talked about. What's the best way to maintain it? Are we just continuing to work in that area on a regular basis?
Right. So okay. I have a personal crutch about when we give a lot of corrective exercises and mini band exercises and all these things to basically get stuff fired up.
Yep.
And then that's like a crutch for the person the rest of their life. Like, I don't think a runner needs to do a mini band or glute bridges before they run every damn day before they run, because that's exhausting. So my thing is if you can improve a range of motion and then show that the athlete is moving well and they da da da, then a general warm up, general strength exercises, the sexy stuff, the deads, the squats, the lunges, things like that, can then be allowed to build horsepower and then build the strength gains that you want.
Yeah.
So that being said, these range of motion drills can be then integrated into a warm-up fashion, but then obviously the volume or the intensity of them can lower as the lesson is more learned, if you will.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's essentially the way I would, back to that hip drill, like, I'm not going to make you do that hip drill every damn time we hang out, because you're going to be super sore. You're going to be pissed off at me. And then the return on interest is a lot less over time. Right.
Yeah.
So I'd rather just have you go play, do sports, go be athletic. And then obviously if movement patterns decrease again, well, you're going to come back and we'll fix it, or you do it on your own.
Interesting. Perfect. Okay. All right. We have a bit of a famous question on this show. It's called our watt point question. And you're familiar with cycling and watts. So we assume that a rider has a 300 watt FTP. Okay. Mm-hmm. They have a poor range of motion. They're bad movement patterns, and they come to you. You fix them. You increase their range of motion. You give them proper range of movement patterns. How many watts is that worth to an athlete?
in what time frame? Sorry to ask. I know it's, I get the point of the question, but
we typically go over a year, right?
You know, we say a year, but I don't know if you need a year. I'm going to give you as much time as you need to correct the range of motion in the movement pattern. You tell me how long that pattern, that period of time is, and you tell me how many watts it's worth.
And so nerd light turned on. Do they get to train more, train harder, or is it status quo?
Let's keep their training the same. You're just fixing their range of motion and movement patterns.
Oh man, on the spot. yeah, I mean, if you were going to say if they were able to train more, then it could be very significant. So I'd say 10 to 15 watts. I know that's for someone that's 300, that's pretty significant. So
yeah.
I would say that's a, if you know, if someone moved like crap, then I think I could turn that around pretty well.
Wow. So just by increasing the range of motion and improving the movement patterns, you can gain 5% basically to your FTP.
Yep. And again, if I had a year, then great, you know, because then they're going to be able to do more things, you know. So we know that training is really simple. You have volume, you have intensity, right?
Yep.
So, and in the interrelation of those two variables gets the output that you want. So, and you're able to give someone the tools to be successful, that's what I like to say, with movement and range of motion and injury prevention, all that good stuff, they can, in theory, do those two variables more or have more peaks or whatnot. And then you could have a much bigger gain of wattage, things like that. So, you know, I would say just from someone that was walking on the ropes of being injured, 10 to 15 watts, because they can be better. They can be just be better because, again, they don't have a horsepower problem. They lack chassis. They have a chassis issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. All right, man. I just want to say that I meet a lot of people, entrepreneurs and experts. I'll say that in quotation marks. And, you know, I've watched you and your partners over the last few years. And I really admire how hardworking you guys are, how well researched you are and committed to your craft. You seldom see that. And it's just really cool to see how well and how hard you guys work. So if user or listeners want to learn more about this system, more about you and Elevate, how can they find out about you guys?
Right. Yeah. So, our website is elevatespc.com. If you're more interested in learning about the functional movement systems itself, you can just do functionalmovementsystems.com. And if you search Las Vegas and Henderson, we'll pop up. So that's nice. On that search engine. Personally, you can reach me at max@elevatespc.com, ELEVATESPC.com.
Yep.
I do a lot of stuff on Instagram as well. So Maximus, that's my stage name, MAXIMUS _Jones. And I post a lot of range of motion work, and just little hacks to help people perform better, you know, or get training again. So
absolutely awesome. Dude, you posted a hip mobility one the other day and I tried it and I couldn't do any of it, so apparently I need to come in and see you and get that sorted out. So
yeah, or I can come out to San Diego and that's way nicer there.
Well, that's also an option. So yeah, we got, it's not gonna be hot here. So anyway, man, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. This is a very interesting episode. Like I said, you're an expert in your space and we really appreciate you coming on, so thank you very much.
Hey, yeah, thanks
guys, appreciate it.
Right,
you
take
guys
care. Take care.
Yep. Hey, this is Chris with Flow. When we're not producing this podcast, our team at Flow is designing some of the fastest carbon fiber bicycle wheels in the world. As a thank you for being a listener of our podcast, Faster by Flow, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase of wheels at flowcycling.com. Head over to our website and pick up a set of wheels to make you faster at your next race or ride. Simply use coupon code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, in all uppercase letters when checking out to get 20% off your order. Thanks again for listening to Faster. We hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to listen to episode 12, where we interview cycling scientist and pro tour advisor Ryan Cooper to learn how to optimize your equipment, bike fit, and race plan to become a faster cyclist. If you enjoyed the show, please help us by sharing our podcast and by leaving a rating or review. If you want to learn more about our company, Flow Cycling, please visit us online at flowcycling.com. That's F as in Frank, LOCYCLING.com. You can also find us under Flow Cycling on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, ride safe.